Good afternoon, this is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. I was on the computer a lot lately, reading stories about cosmology and things like that. There's just so much fascination for me just to read these stories, and I've talked about it before, how I'm just so impressed how scientists can come up with these theories. And there are a lot of beautiful theories, like what happened during the first 3 minutes of the Big Bang. And also, when I first got interested in it, when Brian Cox on BBC Earth talked about the planet Mercury and how there's evidence that it didn't start out where it was. It was something like where Mars is now, something like that. And then it's possible it had one collision or more than one collision with planetoid-type bodies, and it moved into the inner solar system. It's the closest planet to the Sun. And I think Venus has the hottest surface of any planet in the solar system. So you'd think Mercury would, but Venus does because of its greenhouse effect. But Mercury does have a very hot surface. So I believe it's the second hottest planet in the solar system. And an interesting thing, though, is it spins nearly, its axis is almost straight up and down. So there's craters on the poles. I believe it's the North Pole, I'm not too sure. But there's apparently frozen water, ice, in the lips of those craters. So that's another interesting thing about Mercury. And I was talking about how these professors come up, or these scientists, these brilliant scientists, come up with their theories. So Brian Cox explained how Mercury could have moved in to the inner solar system. It was because of some collision with planetoids or planet-type bodies. And that explains it's got a big core and relatively thin crust compared to what the Earth is or other planets like that. But I listened to the show again on the inner planets, and that's an advantage of listening over and over again. You pick up little tidbits of information, and I think Brian Cox said something like this, is that there is, I guess they're called surface volatile elements or atoms on the surface of Mercury, and there was no reason to suspect that those would form on a planet so close to the Sun. So that's why it was said that by Brian Cox that Mercury, they think, moved in from an outer position in the beginning. And there's other things that, of course, there is one lecture I listened to on YouTube about the first 3 minutes after the Big Bang, what happened. And the professor said, what we're talking about is circumstantial evidence, because of course human beings were not there at that time. But he says a lot of crimes, people get convicted on circumstantial evidence. So this circumstantial evidence that we have about Mercury sounded very interesting. And the interesting thing about it was the surface volatiles, because there are some hot Jupiters in other exoplanet systems. And scientists are scratching their heads saying, how can a hot Jupiter form so close to its sun, because its star, because it's possible there's so much heat it would burn off the gas. So Jupiter was thought to have formed out where it is now. It could not have formed closer, because scientists say the gas would have been burnt off. But then they question, why do hot Jupiters exist? Why do they orbit so close to their host stars? So that's a head scratcher. But so some of this, as I said, it's circumstantial evidence. Scientists are not there, and they weren't there at the beginning, but they base it on, for example, Mercury, let's say, 1974 Mariner 10. It flew by, and it saw a cratered landscape, extensively cratered, and some areas that were not cratered. And there was chaotic terrain, hilly and lineated terrain. So it was thought that these terrains formed due to catastrophic quakes and ejecta fallout produced by the antipodal Caloris Basin impact. Okay, so it sounds like there was a meteor or something crashed. But what was surprising about Mercury was the volatile rich surface that was had some elements on there that scientists were surprised. So every mission, the Cassini mission to Saturn, produced a lot of surprises, and every mission does when it's studied more and more. So on Mercury, I'm reading from something that says here, the measured global high abundances of S1, Cl2, so that's silicon and chlorine, and K5 reveal a significant surface record of volatile bearing materials. So also local polar H2O ice form deposits within numerous permanently shadowed crater interiors in the planet's polar regions. So that's what happens, believe, on the surface of the moon. There's some craters that inside their lips, it's permanently shielded from the sun. So these are among the coldest places in our solar system. But what was surprising about Mercury, I guess when you look at the craters, you can say, okay, that makes sense. You have a crater, it has a lip, and inside that lip, somehow there's frozen water there. The sun never shines on that because, as mentioned, the axis of Mercury is almost straight up and down. But then the volatiles, so high abundances of silicon, chlorine, and potassium. So currently documented evidence of surface modifications due to the remain of volatiles include Mercury's hollows, which are shallow, flat-floored, irregular, rimless depressions with bright interiors and halos. So there's a lot of things on Mercury's surface, and I think it's the volatiles that surprise scientists, because what I this is what I got out of it, was that how could a planet that is so close to the sun have these volatiles on its surface where the sun would just burn it off? So there is this kind of evidence that suggests that Mercury formed farther away and it moved in. So it's, as I mentioned, that professor said, it's a British professor. I'll give you his name next show. I don't want to look it up during the show. But a lot of circumstantial evidence goes into this, because of course nothing was around during the Big Bang, and we scientists make these conclusions based on evidence that it's presented to them. So there was impact. So Mercury's surface is heavily cratered, and I guess that makes sense because it's close to the sun, so the sun probably attracts a lot of meteors with its strong gravity. And there's something called the pre-Tolstoyan era and the Tolstoyan era. There's certain things, volcanic material emplaced, dominated these plains. So these age determinations indicate that the onset of chaotic terrain formation must have commenced after 0.39 GA. So GA is the Tolstoyan region, which really doesn't make any sense to me right now. So what I am impressed with is how the scientists use, apparently, let's call it circumstantial evidence. And of course, there's nothing other than circumstantial evidence we can work with things that happened billions of years ago. But it's still quite impressive how scientists make these conclusions. And another thing that I was thinking about during this time when I, here something just popped up. It's called the Nature Briefing Newsletter. So what matters in science? And free to your inbox daily. So I'll sign that up. I'll sign up for it right now because I just clicked it and it put my email there. Okay, so there's a lot of graphs here, and I think I would love to look at this stuff, but then what happens is if I decide to go all in, and look at this article. So this article on Mercury, which I find very fascinating, it's called The Chaotic Terrains of Mercury Reveal a History of Planetary Volatile Retention and Loss in the Innermost Solar System. So it's by J. Alexis P. Rodriguez, and it is published 16th of March, 2020. So another thing about Mercury is they were talking about Mercury there, and they had a couple of scientists. And of course, another impressive thing about these scientists, like when I talked about Trina Ray, I had interviewed her. She's a scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Somebody who I totally envy because she's had the most interesting jobs. She worked on the Voyager mission and then on the Cassini, and now she's going to go on the Clipper mission, where a spacecraft is going to be sent to one of the moons of Jupiter. But I'm so envious of these professors who do something they really love and can sink their whole life into. So Trina Ray, I think she said, "Oh, some of these scientists have been working on Cassini for 25 years." So they work on these projects for a long, long time. So this made me think when I saw these scientists talk about the Mariner spacecraft and Mercury, that's their specialty. And I'm thinking, what would make someone choose Mercury as their specialty, as the planet they're going to study for the rest of their life? And I obviously don't want to criticize it because these people are. Their brains are much bigger than my brain, but you think, okay, let's study a supernova, let's study active galactic nuclei, let's study a galaxy, but instead they choose the planet Mercury. So these people were talking about the planet Mercury, and they're so fascinated about it, and you can tell how when they talk about their things, about their theories, it's very interesting. So I'm wondering, why would someone choose the planet Mercury? So anyway, that's enough about Mercury, and I am going to go to a little bit of space news right now. So there was I think a meteor that struck in something like maybe Nebraska or something. So when I looked that up, I'll look it up on the break. And oh, here it is. Meteor explodes over Vermont with a force of 440 pounds of TNT. So I do not know how you compare that to, let's say, the Hiroshima bomb. What the impact was, what's the difference? But anyway, I'll just read this article quickly. A meteor streaked through the night sky over Vermont on Sunday, March 7th, creating a spectacular light show and causing earth-shaking booms as it burned through the atmosphere. The meteor's explosive package through the atmosphere, or sorry, the meteor's explosive packet passage through the atmosphere released the equivalent of 440 pounds or 200 kilograms of TNT, suggesting that the meteor was likely 10 pounds and 6 inches in diameter, according to NASA Meteor Watch. The space rock smacked into the atmosphere at about 42,000 miles per hour, according to NASA. It appeared over the northern part of the state as a bright fireball at 5:38 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, just before sunset. Local news reported calls from all over the state after the event, with Vermonters describing a loud boom and body-rattling vibration as the meteor passed overhead. So again, there's different terminology. There's a meteor. There's a meteorite and a meteoroid, I think. So I believe if it strikes the Earth, it's called a meteorite. If it passes through the atmosphere, it's a meteor. And before it gets into the atmosphere, it's a meteoroid, something like that. And anyway, here's a little guinea pig or something, a baby that's just born. And that was cute. Okay, so that's one bit of space news. And let's go to another topic now. So, I just thought if I go through this meteor story or this Mercury story, and then I take down all the facts, it'll be more like a lecture. So I like to keep it spontaneous. So even though I had all this stuff it before me, I decided not to do that. So I could have maybe presented in a better way the facts, but as I said, I like to do more spontaneous. So one more thing, the word messenger says Mercury surface space environment geochemistry and ranging spacecraft. So again, the measured global high abundance of S1, Cl2, and K5 reveals a significant surface record of volatile bearing materials. And it says polar H2O in the rims of the craters, but that's not surprising because the moon has that. So that's enough about Mercury now. Now I am going to go, why don't I do this? Spacey Tales, the five strangest meteors. So here's number one, the only known fatality. This partial slice comes from the Valera meteorite. See, meteorite, so when it lands on the Earth, I believe it's called a meteorite, which killed a cow when it landed in Venezuela in 1972. The cow was subsequently slaughtered and eaten, and the meteorite was used as a doorstep. This is the only meteorite known to have been responsible for a fatality. So on the evening of August 15, 1972, farmhands in Trujillo, Venezuela heard a sonic boom. The next morning, a large rock was found alongside a dead cow with a crushed neck and clavicle. Years later, scientists confirmed the rock, which in the meantime had served as a doorstop, was a meteorite, according to the catalog description of New York City's Heritage Auctions, for a partial slice of the Valera meteorite. This is the only known meteorite responsible for a fatality, at least to date. So says Daryl Pitt, the meteorite consultant for the auction, said, and quote, "It's going to happen. It's going to be a very sad day. It is inevitable that people will be killed by a meteorite." And I guess what killed was the dinosaurs was an asteroid. So I think a comet is a snowy, a dirty snowball. A meteorite is just a bunch of iron, and an asteroid, I guess it's something like an iron or a rock. Okay, so now what is the next story is the only asteroid tracked to Earth. The potential for a devastating impact from an asteroid or comet is real, and astronomers are keeping an eye out for this type of threat. On October 2, 2008, Richard Kowalski at the Catalina Sky Survey spotted a new asteroid dubbed 2008 TC3 in a collision course with Earth. For the first time, astronomers around the world tracked the asteroid's approach for the day before it hit Earth. The asteroid exploded upon entering Earth's atmosphere, and as predicted, it fell in the Nubian desert of northern Sudan, where 35 pounds of meteorites were eventually found. Much of its mass is believed to have been vaporized or to have disintegrated when it hit Earth's atmosphere. It was renamed Al-Mahata Sita, Arabic for Station 6. A railroad stop on the line to Khartoum, near where the meteorites were found, according to the auction catalog description. Number three, chained to Earth. In 1492, a stone fell from the sky outside the walled city of Ensisheim, located in the Alsatian region of France, preceded by a giant thunderclap, then a long noise that was heard far around. The auction catalog quotes a 16th century document. The stone descent was seen as a sign from God. The extraterrestrial origin of meteorites would not be accepted for another 300 years. The Ensisheim meteorite was brought into the city and chained up in church to keep it earthbound. It is Europe's oldest preserved meteorite. Number four, hopes for a cure. On August 14, 1992, residents of Nigerian city of Mabele heard a loud explosion that became a rumbling, accompanied by a white smoke trail in the sky. Then rocks rained down, pelting an area of about 4.3 miles by 1.9 miles. One small meteorite even struck a young boy after ricocheting off a banana tree because the region was ravaged by AIDS. Mabele residents believed the meteorite shower brought a cure from God, and they ground up the stones into a paste that was eaten or applied topically. The auction catalog recounts. And, I missed one, but I'll go on. Okay, so now I'm going to go for a break. And when I come back, I'm going to talk more astronomy on CITR 101.9. This is Marco. You are listening to Astro Talk.
Are you looking for a volunteer opportunity that fits your schedule? Being a big sister takes less time than you think, and you can choose the volunteer opportunity that fits your life. Spend just 1 hour a week as a study buddy, tutor, or 2 hours a week as a big sister. Check out the various mentoring programs at Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland and find a volunteer position and a little sister that will suit you to a T. Visit bigsisters.bc.ca for more information today.
Hey there.
Barev.
We're the Armenian Students Association, and we're here to bring together everyone,
Armenians and non-Armenians,
who are interested in learning about the Armenian culture here at UBC.
Find us on Facebook at ASAUBC to stay up to date. We look forward to seeing you at our future events.
Okay, welcome back. This is Marco. While on the break, I was looking up the definition of asteroid. So this is what an asteroid is. A small rocky body orbiting the sun. Large number of these ranging in size from nearly 600 miles across Ceres to dust particles are found in the asteroid belt, especially between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter, though some have more eccentric orbits and a few pass close to the Earth or enter the atmosphere as meteors. So, maybe a meteor and an asteroid is the same thing. And here are another thing. What are asteroids made of? The C-type chondrite asteroids are most common, probably consist of clay and silicate rocks, and are dark in appearance. They are among the most ancient objects in the solar system. The S-types are stony, are made up of silicate materials and nickel iron. The M-types are metallic nickel iron. Okay, so now we know what an asteroid is. So now I'm going to go to a really something that caught my eye, and this is on lifescience.com. The article is called 4.6 billion year old meteorite belongs to Earth's long lost baby cousin. So I saw this last week and I didn't read about it, but I'm going to read about it today. For some reason it caught my eye. So this is by Mindy Weisberger. Again, it's called 4.6 million year old asteroid belongs to Earth's long lost baby cousin, and it's 6 days ago. So it would be, today is the 15th, so it would be about March the 9th. And the subtitle says, a protoplanet in the early solar system spawned a unique type of meteorite. Now, here is a photo of, it's called the EC002 meteorite. Is relatively coarse-grained, tan and beige, with crystals that are green, and yellow-brown. So, I'm going to start reading. A lonely meteorite that landed in the Sahara Desert in 2020 is older than Earth. The primeval space rock is about 4.6 billion years old and is the oldest known example of magma from space. Its age and mineral content hint that the rock originated in our early solar system from the crust of a protoplanet, a large rocky body in the process of developing into a planet, according to a new study. The meteorite called Ergchek 002 or EC002 is likely a rare surviving chunk of a lost baby planet that was destroyed or absorbed by a bigger rocky planet during our solar system's early formation. Pieces of EC002 were found in Adrar, Algeria in May 2020, and the fragments were relatively coarse-grained, tan and beige, sporadically studded with crystals that were larger green, yellow-green, and less commonly yellow-brown, according to a description by the Lunar and Planetary Institute, LPI. EC002 is an achondrite, a type of meteorite that comes from a parent body with a distinct crust and core and lacks round mineral grains called chondrules, according to the Center for Meteorite Studies at the University of Arizona. At Arizona State University, Approximately 3,100 known meteorites originated in crust and mantle layers of rocky asteroids, but they reveal little about protoplanet diversity when our solar system was young. About 95% come from just two parent bodies, and around 75% of those originated from one source, possibly the asteroid 4 Vesta, one of the largest objects in the asteroid belt, the researchers find. So here, something's catching my eye. It's a little video. There was a study on some kind of snake is chasing a little mouse. So they're doing some kind of study about that. Okay, if that's what turns them on, good. Okay, now here's a photo of two pieces of EC002. The main mass of the meteorite resides at the main mineral and gem museum. Okay, meteoritic rarity. Among the thousands of rocky meteorites, EC00 stood out. Radioactive versions or isotopes of aluminum and magnesium indicated that the true meteorite's parent was an ancient body dating to 4.566 billion years ago, and EC002's chemical composition revealed that it emerged from a partly melted magma reservoir in the parent body's crust. Most rocky meteorites come from sources with basaltic crusts, rapidly cooled lava that is rich in iron and magnesium, but EC002's composition showed that its parent crust was made of andesite, which is rich in silica. The study authors reported, and quote, "This meteorite is the oldest magmatic rock analyzed to date and sheds light on the formation of the primordial crust that covered the oldest protoplanets," end quote. While EC002 is highly unusual, other studies have found that such silica-infused andesite crusts were likely common during our solar system's protoplanetary forming stage, contrary to what the meteorite record suggests, the researchers wrote. Okay, here's another quote. The scientist said that remains of primordial andesitic crust are therefore not only rare in the meteorite record, but they are also rare in the asteroid belt, the scientist wrote. So I read through all that, and I was wondering why I read, because something caught my eye about this article, and I'm not saying it's a bad article, but something else caught my eye, and it could be that it was related to the original meteorite description I gave that landed in Vermont. Okay, so, oh, this is the article I wanted to read, so sorry about that. I clicked the wrong article. So here, I thought it's a very interesting article. It's on livescience.com, and the title is "Scientists Want to Store DNA of 6.7 Million Species on the Moon Just in Case." So that's the one that caught my eye. This is by Harry Baker, 18 hours ago, so it would have been written Sunday, March 14th, and it says the lunar arc would be hidden in lava tools. So what does that mean? Oh, lava tubes. Okay, so they called it a lunar arc, so it's just samples of 6.7 million species on the moon of DNA, just in case. So here's a photo of the moon, and it said scientists want to store the DNA of 6.7 million of Earth species on a lunar arc as a backup. I think in the Arctic or something, they have a store of all the seeds and plants of the Earth, so they keep that as in storage. Okay, I'm going to read the article. So again, this is called "Scientists Want to Store DNA of 6.7 Million Species on the Moon, Just in Case." A lunar arc hidden inside the moon's lava tubes could preserve the sperm, eggs, and seeds of millions of Earth species, a group of scientists has proposed. The arc, or gene bank, would be safely hidden in these hollowed-out tunnels and caves sculpted by lava more than 3 billion years ago, and would be powered by solar panels above. It would hold the cryogenically preserved genetic material of all 6.7 known species of plants, animals, and fungi on Earth, which would require at least 250 rocket launches to transport to the moon, according to the researchers. Scientists believe the endeavor could safeguard our planet's wildlife against both natural and human-caused apocalyptic scenarios such as a supervolcano eruption or a nuclear war, and ensure the survival of their genes. So I talked about this about, I believe, 3 or 4 years ago. It could have been longer than that, but Yellowstone is, I think scientists are monitoring Yellowstone, and they don't say they predict it to erupt within the last few years, but on a longer geological scale of maybe 500,000 years or something like that, that's the number that comes to mind, Yellowstone is due to erupt soon. And when it does, if there's a large eruption, Denver is basically gone, and I think Calgary is also gone. So that's bad news, isn't it? So if Vancouver is so close to Calgary, what would happen to Vancouver? But there are all these things that just could happen that we don't have a handle on. And how can we prevent Yellowstone from erupting? So Boo Boo and Yogi called it Jellystone. But anyway, scientists believe the endeavor could safeguard our planet's wildlife against both natural and human-caused apocalyptic scenarios. I just read that. Okay. So, this is so cool. Related. I don't know how it's related, but interstellar space travel. 7 futuristic spacecraft to explore the cosmos. Now, that, and it shows a movie here of a subterranean cavern, which are shielded from radiation, and a lava tube is a tunnel under a world surface formed by an intense flow of molten rock during a volcanic explosion. So if you want to read about this or watch that video, on Earth, they're most easily spotted when they collapse, forming long furrows in the dirt. So that's where they want to store these 6.7 million samples of DNA. The scientists presented their lunar arc plans on Sunday, March 7th at the IAEA Aerospace Conference, which was held virtually this year due to the COVID-19 pandemic. So says lead author Jekhan Thanga, head of the Space and Terrestrial Robotic Exploration Laboratory at the University of Arizona, or Space Trex. This is what this person said, and quote, "There's a strong interconnectedness between us and nature. We have a responsibility to be guardians of biodiversity and the means to preserve it." So that's what I have always thought about. Why don't they just bring these samples of DNA and plant them on the surface of Mars? Just shoot them at Mars and see what happens. And there's this real concern about contaminating places like Enceladus, one of Saturn's moons. So that's why they crashed Cassini into Saturn. But why not try a gamble like that? Bring your DNA and hit this moon or this planet with this DNA or whatever it is, contaminated purposely, and see how. So I guess there's all these scenarios about terraforming Mars, which humans might do one day. So existential threats. The main motivation behind the lunar arc is to create a secure off-world storage facility for biodiversity. So says Thanga again, in quote, "I like to use the data analogy. It's like copying your photos and documents from your computer onto a separate hard drive so you have a backup if anything goes wrong," end quote. Therefore, if an apocalyptic event destroyed the natural world or wiped out most of humanity, there would be a chance to hit a reset button, Thanga said. In their presentation, the researchers listed the following as potential existential threats to biodiversity on Earth: supervolcanic eruption, global nuclear war, asteroid impact, pandemic, climate change acceleration, global solar storm, and global drought. Here's an interesting article. I'll read it a bit later. It says, related, doomsday, 9 real ways the Earth could end. We are going to wait for that, aren't we? Thanga said again, in quote, "Environment and human civilization are both very fragile. There are many types of these really tragic circumstances that could happen," end quote. And this is one thing that I've been thinking about lately. When you read something, when you come across something that says runaway global warming, like what happened on Venus, where you can't control it anymore, where just it flares out of control and there's nothing you can do about this. So we should really be careful about this, because as this says, the environment and human civilization are both fragile. There are many of these really tragic circumstances that could happen. Creating genetic backups to preserve biodiversity is not a new concept. The Svalbard Global Seed Vault, that's what I talked about earlier, located within the Arctic Circle in Norway, holds the genetic samples of plant species from around the world and has already been used to reintroduce certain plants back into the wild. However, that fault is still at risk of being destroyed by rising sea levels or an asteroid strike. Only by storing the genetic information somewhere else in the solar system can we ensure it survives any existential threats to Earth, the researcher said. So, of course, there's all these things that threaten Earth, and we know that global warming scares a lot of people. But it is comforting to know that we have great scientists that are already thinking about this stuff, so it's a good thing. Now, another subtitle called Lava Tubes. The moon was the obvious choice for an off-world arc for one main reason. It is only a four-day journey from Earth, which means transporting the sample is much easier than taking them to Mars. Building an arc in orbit around Earth is also not secure enough due to the instability of orbit, Thanga said. However, another benefit of building an arc on the moon is that it can be safely hidden away in lava tubes. These hollowed-out caverns and tunnels under the surface were formed during the moon's fiery infancy, and they have remained untouched ever since. Lava tubes would protect the arc from meteor strikes and DNA-damaging radiation. The lava tubes have also been suggested as excellent places to build lunar cities for a human civilization on the moon as well, as previously reported on by Life Science. So again, another thing I thought about the moon, or the Mars, going to Mars, and I guess the moon is tied to this because I believe the Artemis program, it's billed as, we're going to explore the moon, but it's pre-Mars. All the stuff we learn about living around the moon and doing all these things on the moon can be used and in going to Mars. But one of the things that really I think about a lot is when going to Mars, so let's say humans eventually go to Mars, and humans face this when they live on the space station or where they go to when they go to the moon or just in outer space in general, is that there's all this space radiation and they have to be protected. So the astronauts have to be protected from it. So there's lots that can be learned about that, because who knows, one day there could be a catastrophic event on Earth, or global warming can go out of control, and or something could happen to the atmosphere, and then we're not as protected as we were before. So these things that are learned on the way to Mars can be applied again on Earth. So they're very useful. It's not just people can say, oh, why do you go to Mars? Why do you spend all this money on space? Well, we are a spacefaring civilization, and one day we might have to deal with a much harsher life where the Earth could be contaminated by radiation. So going to Mars, there's a lot of knowledge that be gained, and it could be used in the future, because you don't know what will happen. So here it is, the basic design of a lunar arc with cryogenic storage modules hidden in lava tubes being powered by solar panels above. So there's an image here. So if you want to know this article again, it's called Scientists Want to Store DNA of 6.7 Million Species on the Moon, Just in Case. It is on LifeScience.com, dated March the 14th, and it's by Harry Baker. So I think this is a very good article. Now let's see, where was I? The scientists presented, not all the technology needed for this ambitious project exists yet, but the researchers think that it could realistically be built within the next 30 years, Thanga said. So I've talked about this before on one particular show about spin-offs in space. There's so many things that are learned in space. For example, freezing things on Earth for maybe the COVID vaccine, heart transplants, Teflon cooking. There's so much that could be cooking with Teflon. Teflon, I believe, was created to shield the space shuttle. So there's so many things that are learned in space that are... I was distracted. My antivirus did a scan, and my computer's pretty good. It's free. So it says here, not all the technology needed for this ambitious project exists yet. But then a lot of these things, for example, warfare and space travel, lots of technology, there's so many technology spin-offs that I think a lot of people would be very surprised at how many technology spin-offs there have been because of space. So I do think it's good to, in the future, it's possible that this planet, we won't be as safe as we once were on this planet. And it could be in 100 years or 1,000 years, we're not safe at all. So all this technology that we gain from going to Mars, going to the moon, doing all this other research about astronomy, it's very useful because our future could be threatened by just something that we do, like global warming, or something that happens in the future. Okay, another subtitle, existential threats. The main motivation behind the lunar arc is to create a secure off-world storage facility. Oh, I already read that. Sorry about that. Okay, so now let's talk about lava tubes. The moon was the obvious choice for one main reason. It has only a 40... Oh, I read that. I'm sorry. I talk too much. An arc could be hidden in lava tubes. If there is a direct hit from a meteor or nuclear strike, the arc should be okay. There could be as many 200 lava tubes that could be suitable for the arc. The researchers propose to first map these tubes using specially designed robots capable of autonomously exploring the caverns and tunnels. I love this stuff. It's so futuristic. The hypothetical Sphere-X robots will resemble large poke balls with a dark metallic gray upper half and bronze lower half, according to Thenga. The Sphere-X robots. The Sphere-X robots would be capable of hopping around the moon's low gravity and mapping the tubes using cameras and LIDAR. LIDAR. I've come across that before. It doesn't tell what it is. A remote sensing method that uses light in the form of pulse laser to measure distances. Once the robots identify a suitable lava tube, then the construction phase could begin. So here it says building the base. The proposed arc would include two main sections above and below ground. The genetic samples would be kept in cryo storage modules inside the lava tubes that would be connected to the surface by elevators. On the surface, a communications array and solar panel would allow the arc to be maintained autonomously, and an airlock would allow for human visitors. So here is a photo, an expanded design of the arc shown without the lava tube. So there's the preservation analysis laboratory, the cryopreservation module, the elevator shafts, the cryopreservation module, and the goods elevator shaft. Pretty cool. Building the ark would be a huge logistical challenge, but Thenga said that upcoming moon missions by NASA and the European Space Agency will lay the groundwork for these types of construction projects. This is a bit longer, so I'm going to go for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about this arc going to the moon. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam, Nisiaya, and the Skakuya, Talit, Homasquim, Mustail. We don't need to tell you that Vancouver has a housing problem.
Mass evictions.
Mass rent evictions.
Unfair rent increases.
What happened to rent control and protection from unfair eviction?
If these or other housing matters concern you, you may be interested in joining the Vancouver Tenants Union. For more information, visit tenantsunion.ca.
Welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. Scientists want to store DNA of 6.7 million species on the moon just in case. This is an article I'm reading. It's on livescience.com. I think it's a very interesting article, very creative, talks about future things that we could do in space. And believe it or not, I guess it has to be accepted, we're a spacefaring race, and we're probably going to populate the solar system one day. So hopefully. So this is on LifeScience.com. So let's go down to that article, that or the part of the article that I was talking about, building the base. Sangha predicts that transporting the samples to the moon will be the most challenging and costly aspect of building the ark, based on some quick back-of-the-envelope calculations, he said. So I wasn't sure if it was a male or a female. And let's say one of these, it says here there's going to be 250 shipments to the moon. There's going to be a lot of stuff shipped. And let's say all of a sudden something crashes on the moon, or something goes out of orbit and flies off and hits another planet and we don't know where it is. And these DNA samples grow into human beings or whatever animals they are. And they evolve and then they come back and they attack Earth. Wouldn't that be cool? And that's what could happen for, like, a civilization on Mars. It could eventually decide to attack Earth. And let's say if travel is to another star system, then it's been said that it's going to be a one-way travel, because you can't travel 20, 30, 40 years and then get there and then say, okay, I'm going to come back. Probably you couldn't come back. So the logistics of that trip would be something else. So imagine this civilization develops in another world, and then they grow a third arm, or they might grow a claw, or they might grow a third eye in the back of the head. And then they might say, oh, look at Earth abandoned us. We're going to attack them. So Sangha predicts that transporting the samples to the moon will be the most challenging and costly aspect of building the ark. Calculations assume that 50 samples of each species would be needed to successfully reintroduce a species. However, reintroducing each species could actually take as many as 500, which would mean many more rockets were needed, Sangha said. These calculations also don't include the launches needed to transport the necessary materials to build the ark in the first place. So I'm wondering, if we do habitate the moon, are human beings going to bring up dogs and other animals and flowers and try to build another Earth? And they could evolve into something different. That would be so cool. So says Sangha, and quote, it will cost hundreds of billions of dollars to build the ark and transport samples. But this isn't totally out of the question for international collaborations like the UN, end quote. So, by the way, Russia and China have proposed building a joint space station on the moon. I guess one on the surface and one orbiting. So we'll see what happens about this. So here's another subsection called Super Cold Robots. Even so, one aspect of the lunar ark is currently out of reach. In order for the samples to be cryogenically preserved, they must be stored at extremely low temperatures between minus 292 and minus 321 degrees Fahrenheit, or minus 180 to minus 196 degrees Celsius. This means that it would be impractical to use humans to sort and retrieve samples from the cryo storage modules. Instead, robots would have to do the heavy lifting. But at such low, see, there's a lot of logistics involved in this. But at such low temperatures, the robots would freeze to the floor via cold welding, where metals fuse together under freezing temperatures. The solution, according to the researchers, is quantum levitation. Wow, this technology is so cool. This theoretical solution is basically a supercharged version of magnetism, using superconductive materials to fix objects in a magnetic field. So quantum levitation. See, they have to think of a lot of things. So here they have to think about, if it's too cold, the robots would freeze to the floor via cold welding. So imagine going to the moon, how complicated, or going to Mars, how complicated. The scientists have to consider all these amazing things. So here they're going to talk about the robots. They got to levitate them. And with a supercharged version of magnetism, using superconductive materials to fix objects in a magnetic field. So says Sangha again, and quote, you can have things at a distance being pinned down together, so you can move the robots via levitation. It's as if, you know, they have invisible strings or ropes attached to them, end quote. So the string, where I just read the word string, that's one thing I wanted to talk about, was string theory at the beginning. I'll talk a bit about it later, okay? Quantum levitation isn't possible yet, but It will also be needed in the future for other cryogenic products like long-haul space travel, so it is only a matter of time before someone works out how to do it, Thanga said. The researchers say that a 30-year time frame is possible, but if humanity were faced with an immediate existential crisis, it could be done much faster, Thanga said. So says Thanga again, and quote, "This is a project that will require real urgency to have a lot of people energized enough to go after it. I think it could be achieved within 10 to 15 years if needed." Wow, this was an article that I love to read. It touches upon the future and a very interesting topic. And it some of these things talk about, it presents something, it says, okay, this is my idea, and then it doesn't really give any background on the idea or any of the logistics of the idea. And it's possible that some of this stuff, like, for example, when you're talking about quantum mechanics, it's possibly so complicated that unless you're a specialist in the field, you couldn't understand it. But this kind of article talked about some of the logistics, some of the solutions, which is very interesting. I just happened to toggle down and it says, why do dogs and cats run around in random bursts of speed? And you see that little cows do it, little goats, and also hamsters. You could put a hamster down, and all of a sudden it'll just be sitting there motionless. All of a sudden, boom, it runs like crazy. And I guess I see outside that squirrels do it too. So this was an interesting article, and what I liked about it, it's futuristic, and it's all about what humans could do in the future in terms of storing DNA to preserve the species and preserve life as we know it. So they want to store DNA of 6.7 million species on the moon. And I was wondering why it would take 250 launches, because DNA is pretty small stuff. Couldn't they just all launch it all at once? But anyway, this talks about a lot of things about the lava tubes and on the moon and how to store it and the type of technology you have to have super cold robots, which is so cool. So our society is our world is such a cool place because we are starting to explore all these things. But also you think it is very scary because the type of technology and the kind of competition, because I'll just grab one topic at random. When the Europeans colonized the world, and then they took the resources from the Asian countries that they colonized, and there was colonial wars and rebellions, and the Europeans fought each other for this. And how can human beings avoid not doing this in space, where China and Russia say, okay, we are going to build this base on the moon. And the US, whenever it does something, it usually has the European Space Agency, and the Japanese Space Agency does a lot of things with it. And it helped bring Canada along, which is really, really cool. And do the Russians and the Americans do cooperate on stuff? Because after the space shuttle was abandoned and stuff, a lot of the launches to the space station were from Russia. I forget the name of the place. But some of the launches now have been done in the U.S. up to the space station. So Elon Musk, and I think that's one of the great things, that advantages Americans have. They have private citizens like Elon Musk. And a few weeks ago, I talked about a Japanese citizen, a billionaire that wants to look into space travel. So, to me, and to a lot of people now, because of this Perseverance mission to the Mars, it's captured the imagination of a lot of people. A lot of people are spellbound by, wow, look at that machine and stuff. And yes, I am spellbound by it too, but I've been reading about Mars for a lot of years. And I think what's happened in Mars is the same old thing now. They send machines up and try to discover if life could have existed before on Mars. So to me, it's not as exciting, but talking about this this robot and habitation on Mars, or going to Mars. And I also thought about, and a lot of people probably have thought along the same line, was that here we have a solar system. Our solar system, let's just pick a nice round number, let's say 5,000 years in the future. Will human beings be living on different bodies in the solar system? Will Earth be controlling these places? And just like on Mars, where Arnold Schwarzenegger, I forget what it's called, something Impact, I forget, where he was with Sharon Stone, where there's rebellions on Mars, and the ruler there was Cohagen, and he was oppressing the people. And will we have a scenario where there's, what kind of future? It's just so fascinating, but it is also a bit scary and eerie. So again, what I wanted to talk about, there's a lot of articles, but here's one that's so cool. That's what I love. LiveScience.com, there's a thing, article called Interstellar Space Travel, 7 Futuristic Spacecrafts to Explore the Cosmos. So here it's Project Daedalus, Project Icarus, LightSail, Buzzard Ramjet, Antimatter Rocket and Black Hole Drive, Human Slowboats, and Faster Than Light. There's another spacecraft to talk about Faster Than Light. So I won't talk about that. I'll end the show talking about something that I wanted to talk about in the beginning. And that was, I won't say it yet. But what I noticed is here's an example, gravitational lensing. A few years ago, gravitational lensing was so cool. And it was talked about on every show and on the internet, and we just couldn't get enough about gravitational lensing. And there's all kinds of dark matter now. We heard about dark matter for a long time. But one thing that I did hear about, and I wanted to talk about, and I'll talk about it now, was string theory. So string theory was all the rage, and I believe there was a professor in Philadelphia that was the leading proponent of string theory and maybe the genius. They called him the next Einstein. And they talked about, like, string theory is it. String theory is what is going to explain the universe. So here I'm going to read a definition about string theory. String theory. In physics, string theory is a theoretical framework in which the point-like particles of particle physics are replaced by one-dimensional objects called strings. String theory describes how these strings propagate through space and interact with each other. What is string theory, plain and simple? String theory proposes that the fundamental constituents of the universe are one-dimensional strings. I think they're supposed to link the universe together. String theory also requires 6 or 7 extra dimensions of space, and it contains ways of relating the large extra dimensions to small ones. Reason I brought this up is because string theory was all the rage years ago, and then it just seems to have disappeared from the news. So some theories only allowed vibrations to travel in one direction on the strings, while others allowed both. And some theories were combinations of other theories. So there was 5 types of string theories: are type 1, 11A, 11B, SO32 Herodic, and E8X, E8 heterotic. And it says another thing here: is string theory still a thing? This new theory, called quantum chromodynamics, or QCD, today remains our theory of the strong nuclear force. And as for string theory, it mostly faded into the background, and today that string theory also remains, still attempting to explain the strong force. So there is the reason I brought this up. Was that string theory seemed to be all the rage years ago, and Kip Thorne used to talk about what was it called? I forgot his theoretical construct of, let's say, time travel. What's it called when you can travel through a black hole? Black holes and time warps. Forget what it's called. But anyway, John Swartz and Andrew Nouveau of Princeton University created such a reformulation of string theory. The new string theory had the advantage that it did not require for consistency with special relativity and quantum theory the existence of a tachyon and a world of 26 dimensions. So they talk about a lot of extra dimensions, and they've talked about different things about string theory, but the point I brought it up is string theory seemed to be the thing. The person, I remember they were interviewed on 60 Minutes, and it was saying, oh, here we go, we've solved the problem of unifying quantum and Einstein stuff, and we're on our way now. And then it just faded into obscurity, or that's what it seems to me. So the strings move and vibrate at different frequencies, giving particles distinctive properties like mass and charge. The strange idea could unite all the fundamental forces, explain the origins of fundamental